Well, good morning. Last week, some of you saw our Facebook page. We were back in Michigan, and Stephen was graduating there at Andrews University. And then from there, I flew home. Karen then flew to Southern College, where Nathan is attending school. They just completed their finals, and she is driving with Nathan now across America because he's got to bring his car back home. And, you know, Mom was worried about him. I said, he can drive, but he'll be alone. I said, he'll survive. Where's he going to stay? He can't get, 19 years old. They won't let you stay in a hotel, even if you have a credit card. I said, hotel? I didn't stay in a hotel when I was... Mothers are so... Anyway, so she's driving cross-country. She texted me this morning. They're spending Sabbath together in Santa Rosa, New Mexico. And so I appreciate your prayers for them as they travel. But fathers and mothers are different. Did you know that? That's profound. Write that down. And, tomorrow being Mother's Day, I'm thankful for the opportunity, really, to talk to you about one of the great examples of a godly mother in the Bible. And her name is Hannah. Hannah's one of those names, H-A-N-N-A-H. It's the same forward or backwards. Did you know that? So if you're wondering what to name your daughter and never get mixed up, that's a good name. But you first find this in the book of Samuel. So if you'll join me and turn to the first book of Samuel. Now, I'll give you a little background because this is going to be a Bible study. The first book of Samuel originally was part of four books of the Kings, really. And you've got 1 and 2 Samuel. You've got 1 and 2 Kings, and then it goes on, and there's some repeat in 1 and 2 Chronicles. But this is the beginning of a whole different epic. You've got the story of the Exodus in the Torah that ends with the death of Moses, and Joshua really begins the time of the Judges. Then at the end of the Judges, you have Samuel. Samuel is a transition point to the time of the kings and the kingdom that reaches to the birth of Christ. And so this is just a really great study. You'll see a lot of interesting things are happening here in this story. And it begins, go to verse 1, 1 Samuel chapter 1, verse 1. Now there was a certain man of Ramathaim Zophim in the mountains of Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah. Elkanah means God created. The son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zoph, an Ephraimite. Now I had to get an amen just for being able to say all of that. So, but there's something in those names that are given. Let me tell you what's going on here. Is first of all, as you read the Bible, you'll find that Elkanah comes from the Kohathites of Levi, one of the sons of Levi, which was one of the most esteemed tribes. So he's a Levite. So later when he's going to the temple, he's performing the duties of a Levite. But the Levites didn't get any specific territory. They were to be divided among the 12 tribes, and they were given certain territory around the towns. And so it tells you from what town. Now he lives at Ramathaim of Zophim. Now Ramathaim, later known as Ramah, became the city of Samuel for the rest of his life. It's up north. Now the temple is not at Ramah. The temple is in, and we got a map I think we're putting up on the screen that's going to show you some of the locations where you can see where the town was. It's pretty small, but you can see at the top you've got Ramah of Benjamin, and then you get about halfway down through the screen you see Jerusalem. Off to the right there's a star, and it says Shiloh. We know where Ramah was, we know where Benjamin was in Gibeah, and we know where Jerusalem was and Bethlehem, you see, at the very bottom of the screen. They never really have found the town of Shiloh. The temple was stationed there before it was moved to Jerusalem. When people went to the house of God, they didn't go to Jerusalem back then. They went to wherever the tabernacle was, and it was still moving around a little bit, but it spent many years at Shiloh. Now, in the genealogy of Elkanah, you notice that it says he's a son of Tohu, the son of Zoph. Zoph was an Ephraimite. Now, this is from Bethlehem Ephrathah. This is the same, it's saying that Zoph was one of the Levites that lived in Bethlehem, so it's making a connection between Samuel and the priests and Samuel and David the king. But there's something else here that is very interesting. When it says Ramathaim, a Thaim is talking about the double hills of Ramah. And you've heard of Joseph of Arimathea, the one who was responsible for burying Jesus. He went to Pilate and got the body. And so this is where he was from. And so you see the intersection of at least three very famous Bible characters and places just in that first verse. So there's a lot there. Sometimes we just skip over those names and places, but it's giving you some connection with the life of Samuel. Now, Elkanah, it goes on to say, has two wives. This was not because it was God's original plan, but you can find several examples in the Bible of patriarchs and other people in Israel that had multiple wives. Sometimes this would happen if a man died and he had no children, his brother would take the wife into the family, and he sometimes would end up with two wives. This happened to Jacob. He didn't do it by design. His father-in-law tricked him, and Jacob ended up with Rachel and Leah. And then when they were having problems having children, they urged upon Jacob their handmaids, Zilpha and Bilhah. And so he ended up with four wives, technically. You remember when Sarah couldn't have children, she pushed into Abraham's arms Hagar. And he ended up with two wives, at least for part of the time. Well, they did not have Social Security in Bible times. And if you grew old and you had no children, you either needed to get taken in by a relative or you could be destitute. Having children was so very important. And so, as a matter of fact, let me read you a few verses. Exodus 23, verse 25. One of the blessings that God gave his people, he said, "There will be no one miscarrying or barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days." Deuteronomy 7:14. "You will be blessed above all people. There will be not a male or female barren among you." Now this is an interesting verse because it not only talks about barrenness because of females, it talks about barrenness because of males. "Neither will there be a male or female barren among you or even among your livestock." Psalm 128, verse 3, "Your wife will be like a fruitful vine in the very..." When was the last time you called your wife a fruitful vine? But that was a compliment in Bible times. "In the very heart of your house, your children like olive plants all around your table." And so, keep in mind, the earth was not nearly as populated back then as it is today. God had told Adam and Eve, "Go forth, be fruitful, and multiply." And so when they were not multiplying, it was seen as a problem. And it says there in the second verse that this man had two wives, Hannah and Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah did not. Now the name Hannah means beauty, charm, or grace. It's sort of a multifaceted word. Peninnah means a jewel. Now there's a conflict that begins to take shape between these two women. And evidently when Elkanah married Hannah, that was his first love. But after several years of marriage, there were no offspring, and he began to worry that there never would be. And so who knows whether Hannah was part of the conversation or not, but for whatever reason, he took a second wife. And she was very productive. And all of a sudden, there were many children added to the family. And every time that happened, Hannah began to feel more and more left out, and more isolated, and more like, "What's wrong with me? And how come I can't have children?" And it turned into a real problem, caused a lot of strife in the family. Verse 3, "This man," chapter 1, verse 3, "This man went from his city yearly to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts at Shiloh." That's where the temple was. "Also the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord, were there." Eli's getting older at this point. "And whenever the time came for Elkanah to make an offering, he would give portions to Peninnah his wife and to her sons and daughters." So she's got sons and she's got daughters. She's got several children. But Hannah has none. But to Hannah he would give a double portion, a worthy portion, for he loved Hannah. Now, how much was served as a portion in these feasts was an indication of love. Do any of you remember when Joseph was testing his brothers, he invited them over to his house for a feast, and he gave all of his brothers a portion of food, but he said, give five times more to Benjamin. I want to see if they're jealous. And they used to give a portion to somebody. And, you know, I'm a vegetarian now, but when I grew up, we ate chicken in our home. Now, I actually gave up eating chicken before I became a general vegetarian because I went to a summer camp that took us to a chicken slaughterhouse. That's all it took. But I remember when we ate chicken that, you know, it'd be usually my mother and my brother and I. There's three of us, but the chicken only had two wings. And we would sometimes fight over the portions or the parts. We always fought over the wishbone, who got to make the wish. And I won't ask for a show of hands. Not in this group, anyway. That could get you in trouble. But when they'd bring their sacrifices, they'd bring a goat or they'd bring a calf, and some, the worthy portion was like the shoulder. The priest was given a certain portion when he offered to take home to his family. And so Elkanah brought this, and he's dividing it up, and he's cutting a nice piece, and he's putting a double portion for Hannah because he knows, you know, Peninnah and all her kids, they're all getting something, and Hannah, she has no children. He's trying to make her feel better. He loves her. And he'd give her a worthy portion. For he loved Hannah, even the Lord had closed her womb. And then it says something interesting. Her rival also provoked her. You know who her rival is? Some of you have King James that does it say adversary. Do you know what the word Satan means? Adversary. And so Peninnah provoked her severely to make her miserable because the Lord had closed her womb. Now, how do you think those conversations went? She said, well, obviously God is with me and he's blessed me, but what's your problem? And I'm so thankful all these kids are going to take care of me in my old age. I wonder what you're going to do. And just was constantly rubbing it in. You're taking too much room in the house. I've got all the children. I need more room. And since you're not taking care of children, could you at least do the dishes? I've got so many children to take care of. I mean, she just knew how to just goad her. And I tell you, this, there was strife in the family. By the way, every time the Bible talks about polygamy, you'll also see there was strife. It's very clear that this was not God's original plan. I think you've heard me say many times that someone asked Benjamin Franklin, that this was an advocate for polygamy. They said, you can't show me one verse in the Bible that says a man can't have two wives. And Ben Franklin said, no man shall serve two masters. That was his answer. But it just brought terrible strife in the family. And it was kind of like Jacob, Rachel, and Leah, in that Leah started out having children, but Jacob loved Rachel. And so it just made Leah feel jealous of her sister. Yes, she had children, but her sister had her husband's love. She was the wife that he never wanted. You know, she got urged on him. And so who knows how Peninnah, you don't want to be too hard on her. She's thinking, oh, you know, maybe Hannah was better looking. He loved her, and she felt insecure. And so there was this constant rivalry and tension in the home. But it doesn't say Hannah was provoking Peninnah. It says Peninnah was provoking Hannah, making her life miserable. And it was intensified whenever they went up to worship God. You know, when you go to worship God and you go to the house of the Lord, the devil will do everything he can to provoke and cause problems. Take your mind off worship. Now, it's good that she's going to the house of the Lord, but you see this is tension. You know, this is not the first time in the Bible that you see a tension between two women over their children. I just mentioned the tension that you see between Rachel and Leah. And they had a tug of war with Jacob as these kids were being born. And, you know, you don't want to think about it too much, but he's got four wives that must live in, what, four different tents. And I don't know if they, you know, cast lots about where he stayed from day to day. But you read the story of Jacob, and there was a lot of strife in that family because of that. Look at what happened in the household of Abraham between Sarah and Hagar. And when they weaned Isaac, Ishmael was mocking. And there, you just see that there's this strife going on. There's a strife going on between two women in the story of Solomon. Who is the real mother? They're fighting over this baby boy. You can see in the second book of Kings, there's two women that come to the king, and they're fighting over, during a time of terrible famine, they're fighting over cannibalism and a boy. Now that all starts to sound strange, but then you go to Revelation, and you've got Babylon, a woman, and you've got a bride in Revelation 12, and there's this tension between these two women that goes all the way through the Bible. And it's really between the true and the false. Now, I always ask this question, even though I've asked it many times, what does a woman represent? Because there's some here that may not know. But in Bible symbols, a woman represents what? What does God want the church to do? Grow. Go ye therefore, teach all nations, baptize. Baptism is like a new birth. And he wants the church to multiply. Is that right? And so for a barren church, that's not good. And so this has, you know, broader implications in the spiritual realm. So there's this rival. There's this tension. And year by year, verse 7, when she went up to the house of the Lord, that she provoked her. Therefore she wept, and she did not eat. It was just breaking her heart. And year after year, she kept hoping, will there be a chance? Will I have a child? Nothing happens. And year after year, Peninnah keeps having children. Hannah feels more isolated, more forsaken, and the other ladies in the town sort of shake their heads and murmur and wonder what's wrong with her, and God, she must have some sin in her past, and that's why God is cursing her like this, and all kinds of things that people say. And she was brokenhearted. And Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Hannah, why do you weep? Now he asks three whys. Why do you weep? Why do you not eat? Why is your heart grieved? Am I not better to you than 10 sons? And some commentators were wondering, does that mean that Peninnah had 10? Or was he just saying that as a general comparison? He's saying, look, I love you more than the love you could get from 10 sons. Now, if Hannah represents the church, then who does Elkanah represent? Represents the Lord, his love for us. So Hannah arose after they had finished. The they finishing is not her. She didn't eat. She's fasting. She's praying. And she goes back to the house of God. The they is Elkanah and Peninnah and all their kids. When they get done eating, Hannah gets up. She leaves. She goes by herself. She goes to the house of God. Now Eli the priest was sitting on a seat by the doorpost of the tabernacle of the Lord. And she was in bitterness of soul. And she prayed to the Lord, and she wept in anguish. Now, she was just overcome, thinking, I can't go on like this. And she made a vow. And she said, O Lord of hosts, just in case you're interested, this is the first time Lord of hosts is used in the Bible. The word Lord of hosts is Lord of Sabaoth. It means Lord of armies. And it may be that Samuel chose to use this term because at this time they were being terribly oppressed by their enemies, principally the Philistines. And she makes a prayer, and she says, Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction, she's being afflicted, persecuted, of your maidservant, and remember me, and forget not your maidservant, but you will give your maidservant a male child, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor will come upon his head. Now, what does that mean? No razor coming on? That's the vow of the Nazarite that you find in Numbers chapter 6, verse 2, that they were never to cut their hair. It could be a temporary vow, and it could be a vow for life. In the case of Samson, it was supposed to be a vow for life. Jesus may have been a Nazarite. You know, there's one verse where Matthew says he came from Nazareth. As the scripture says, he would be a Nazarite. But Jesus drank wine and ate grapes. And the way that some commentators reconcile that is that Christ may have lived as a Nazarite. He was a promised child, like Samson and like Samuel, up until his baptism. You didn't have to do it your whole life. There could be a set period that you would go till. And maybe Jesus was... That's one reason that you often see Jesus painted with longer hair, is because they say, well, if he was a Nazarite, his hair would not have been cut, which means it was either shorter than you see or probably longer than you see in most pictures. But so she's saying, I'll make this vow. I will consecrate him to you, to serve you, to be completely dedicated to you. Now, in your Bible history, if you could do a timeline, the time of the judges is not quite over yet. The time of the kings has not begun. They're in the time of the last judge. Eli was not a judge. He was a priest. Do you know who was judge of Israel at the time when Hannah went to the temple? A guy named Samson was still alive. He doesn't factor prominently in this story because he was from the tribe of Dan, which was in a different location. But he was leading the people in battles against the Philistines. You know about Samson's conflict with the Philistines. So there was some spiritual declension in the kingdom because of the sons of Eli, because Samson wasn't always the best example. But Hannah says, I'll offer him as a Nazarite if you'll hear my prayer. And she makes this vow to the Lord. And it happened as she continued praying, there may have been more to her prayer, that Eli watched her mouth. And Eli spoke, and Hannah spoke in her heart only, her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Eli therefore thought she was drunk. Now she's so overcome, she's not praying with reserve and dignity quietly. But have you ever seen at the Wailing Wall some of the Jews when they're standing there and they're praying, the Orthodox Jews, you'll see them rocking as they're praying. Sometimes they get the prayer book. Sometimes you'll see them go like this. They're rocking. Some of them do this because they're mimicking the emotion of Hannah when she went to the house of the Lord, hoping they'll be heard because they're praying with anguish. And she was just so overcome that her body was shaking, her mouth was moving, she was swaying under the grief, saying, Lord, I can't do this anymore. And the only resolution for my problem is that you show me mercy, that you've not forsaken me by giving me a son. I'm not asking for this for me because I will give him back to you to show you that I worship you more than the gift you'll give me. I'll give him back to you, but you've got to show me that you're with me. And so she's pouring out her heart. Now, do you think this was the first time that she'd prayed? Is God going to answer her prayer? You know the story. Did I ruin it for you? Do you sometimes need to pray for something several times before you get an answer? Do you sometimes need to pray for something to the point where you get where you've just absolutely, you're praying with all of your heart and all of your soul, and she had gotten to the point where she was, her whole being was invested in this prayer to God. Sometimes God will let you get to that point before he gives you the answer, because when he then gives you the answer, you are so happy because of the answer. I saw this, it's somewhat connected. I saw a report on the news yesterday. A lady in southern Florida, name is Mary Ann is the first name. She's been blind for 20 years from a car accident. And suddenly, she fell again in her home. She's blind, used a cane, she fell again. They took her to the doctor. The doctor, after examining her, she opened her eyes. She could see. She had been blind for 20 years, and she said it was just a miracle. And something about the second accident, they think, restored the flow of blood to her eyes or her brain or whatever it was. And she said, but she got a bonus. Before her accident, her whole life, she was colorblind, and now she sees colors. And she said, I am so happy. I am so happy. It's a miracle. And they showed the doctor on the news, and he said, we've never seen anything in science like this before. The only thing, he said, I'm just guessing that blood was restored to some part of her brain that was still alive, but not enough blood to make her eyes work or whatever. So that doesn't even make sense. But the doctor said, it's a miracle. 20 years blind, suddenly she could see perfectly. And she said, the sunshine, I can see my pets, I can see my house, I can see my family. And she said, I am the happiest person in the world. Now, wait a second. She's the happiest person in the world because she can do what we all do all the time, most of us. But not having it for 20 years changes everything. If God gives Hannah a baby, she's going to be the happiest person in the world. Not all of you still feel that way about yours, do you? So see, it's relative, isn't it? Sometimes God makes us do without something so that when we finally get the answer, we really appreciate it. And the trials that we go through in this life for being Christians, when we get to heaven, we are going to like heaven so much more. We'll enjoy heaven more than the angels because they don't know what it's like to be blind. They don't know what it's like to be barren. Well, I guess they do know what it's like to be barren. But that was a detour. But it made a point. That's quite a story. You ought to look that up. I'm going to use that for an amazing fact this weekend. So she makes a vow. She's making a big promise. That'd be a vow you'd be tempted to break, wouldn't you? I know some young ladies, they join the military. And while they're in the military, you know, you're allowed to get married and have relationships. They get pregnant. And they're so excited about being in the military, but then they have a baby. Now, they've made a promise when they join the military that I am going to serve, I'm going to defend the country, I'm going to go where you send me, I'm going to fight for the freedom of the country, whatever it is, wherever you're deployed. But then they have a baby. They start to reconsider that covenant. And they say, I can't leave my baby. And it happens frequently that these young ladies look for every loophole they can find to get out of their obligation to the military and not keep that vow. Because they say, oh, I got a baby. Hannah is, God's going to give her her first baby. She'll be surrounded by a lady that's got many babies. And she says, I am going to give my first and my best to God if you just give me a baby. That's a pretty big commitment. And once you make something like it, you utter a vow like that, that'd be hard to keep, wouldn't it? So she says, let your maidservant do this. Well, Eli's watching her and he thinks she's drunk because he's rocking back and forth. And he says to her, how long will you be drunk? Put your wine from you. Can you think of another time in the Bible when someone was filled with the Spirit and they were confused for being drunk? On the day of Pentecost, when the disciples were filled with the Holy Spirit and they're speaking in tongues, and the rabble that were in the street said, they're full of new wine. They're mocking, new wine won't make you drunk. They were just saying that because often people who were drunk said, oh, I thought it was new wine. And so they're mocking them. But here she's filled with the Spirit. And he said, put away your wine. Now he's the priest, and he totally misjudges what's on her heart. Because God, man looks on the outside, only God looks on the heart. You know, later Samuel looked on the outside and he saw the sons of Jesse, and he saw Eliab, the oldest son. He said, surely the Lord's anointed is before me. And God said, don't look on the outside. That's not the one I've chosen. Sometimes people don't know what's going on in a person's heart. And the Bible Answer program, you know, every Sunday people call in, they'll ask a question. And I'm always wondering, why are they asking this question? And sometimes I try to guess, and I find out, boy, as I continue talking, I thought, I totally misunderstood where they're coming from. Sometimes a person will ask a question about suicide. And they say, will a person who commits suicide be lost? Now, I'm always conflicted when I get that question, because there's two completely different ways I need to think about that. One person is asking that question because they're thinking about suicide. And I tell that person, don't even think about it, because you will put yourself in a permanently bad situation. Suicide is an act of faithlessness and hopelessness, and the prospects for a person being saved after the last act of their life being self-murder, that's not good. You're trying to discourage them from suicide. And then I find out, no, they're asking because someone they love committed suicide, and they wonder, is there any hope for them to be saved? Then I shift gears. I say, only God knows the heart. We don't know. We can hope and pray. You know, it's a hope. And so you don't know where they're coming from. You don't know what's in their heart. And Eli completely misjudged. Now, one reason he misjudged, you read on in the story, you find out that Eli's sons were bad boys. And they were misbehaving with some ladies that hung out at the sanctuary. And Eli is exasperated by this. All he does is chide them verbally. And he's wondering if Hannah, maybe, she's acting drunk and she might be one of these women of ill repute. Put away your wine from you. And Hannah said, no, my Lord. I'm a woman of a sorrowful spirit. I've neither drunk wine or intoxicating drink. Indeed, I'm promising if I've got a son, he's never going to drink his whole life. I poured out my soul before the Lord. Do not consider your maidservant a wicked woman, for out of the abundance of my complaint and grief I've spoken until now. And Eli, he can tell by how articulate she is, she's not drunk. Got a friend that got pulled over. He's actually attended church here a couple times for swerving on the road. The highway patrolman thought he was drunk. He actually just driven a long time and he was a little tired. It turns out he was also a very good acrobat. He was in a gym team. And the policeman said, all right, out of the car. You've been drinking? No, I've not been drinking. I swerved a little bit on the line. I've been following you. And I saw, I'm not drunk. I don't drink. All right, he drew a line. Remember when they used to do that? Said, I want you to walk the line. My friend told me, he says, I got up, I stretched a little bit. And he said, then I flipped up on my hands and I walked the line on my hands. Policeman said, I'm sorry, I guess I misjudged. So when he heard how articulate she was, he said, no, she doesn't sound like someone who's drunk to me. She said, I poured out my soul. And then Eli, he's just thinking, oh, I misjudged her. I hope I didn't offend her. And wanting to comfort her, he doesn't know what she's prayed. In verse 17, Eli answered and said, go in peace, and the God of Israel grant you the petition that you've asked of him. And she said, let your maidservant find favor in your sight. This is the high priest. He is the highest religious voice in the kingdom. Now, you read about Eli, and he had several problems. But because Hannah was praying with a sincere heart, when Eli said, go in peace, the God of Israel grant your petition, did Eli have the power to tell everybody God's going to answer your prayer? Well, that's really up to God. But because of his office, and because she'd been talking to the Lord, because it was a holy place during a holy feast, when he spoke and said, God is going to grant you your petition, he was just trying to encourage her. She took a hold of that word, and she believed it. And as soon as she believed that, and after she prayed, she poured out her heart, she felt comfort that God was going to hear her prayer. And it says, so the woman went away, and she ate. She's not fasting anymore. And her face was no longer sad. And Peninnah would come and start to taunt her, and she couldn't get to her. And they're going, what's come over her? She's smiling. She's happy. You know what made the difference? She believed that the word that she spoke was the word of God, and she found comfort in it. Now, you know, this is very interesting when you think about it. Can God speak through someone that doesn't even know that God is speaking through them? You know how many times I've preached a sermon? And afterward I'll meet someone at the door and they'll say, Pastor, that was exactly for me. Well, I didn't mean it for you. I don't even know who you are. I mean, God can do that. Can God speak through a donkey? Do you know God even prophesied through the high priest that condemned Jesus? John chapter 11. You read in verse 49. And one of them, Caiaphas, being high priest that year, he said, you know nothing at all, nor do you consider that it's expedient for us that one man should die for the people and not the whole nation should perish. John goes on and comments, now this he did not say on his own authority, But being high priest that year, he prophesied. He unwittingly was making a prophecy that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for that nation only, but also for gather together in one the children of God who are scattered abroad. John is saying, because of his office of being high priest, he didn't even realize that what he said was prophetic in nature. That one man should die for the nation. Jesus did die for the nation, and John says for everybody. When Eli said, go in peace, the God's going to grant you your petition, he didn't know. God can speak through a minister. I got to be careful how I say this because I don't want to give you the wrong impression. God can speak through a minister who is himself lost. I've met people before, and I won't mention the names, but they'll come to an evangelistic meeting. I'll say, well, when did you accept Christ? They said, I accepted Christ at a so-and-so evangelistic meeting. Well, this person was later in the headlines and found out to be a womanizer, a fraud, stealing money, or whatever it was. And said, I went to their meetings. I heard the word of God. I gave my heart to Jesus, and I've been a Christian ever since. And they are real Christians, even though the preacher wasn't right. Now, I say this because when Hannah has this prayer answered, it is one of the lowest times spiritually for the church. Eli is wishy-washy. His sons are sleeping with the women that come to the church. They're stealing from the people the offerings. And it just was a spiritually low time. Samson is gone and hanging out with Delilah. But in spite of what was going on in the church, she came. She's worshiping with her husband the time they're supposed to worship, the way they're supposed to worship. God hears her prayer. God answers her prayer, which means you cannot blame your spiritual condition on what's going on in the church or with the pastor. Suppose that a pastor marries you and your spouse, and that pastor gives up his faith. Do you have to go find another pastor to remarry you? Or if a pastor baptizes you and they later give up their faith, is your baptism still valid? Because they just represent something that's between you and God. Her prayer was between her and God. Now that's going to come in to be a very important point a little later in the story. And here you have a sacred book that was in the temple. It's a sacred place. He held a sacred office, sacred feast, sacred time. So you got 4 out of 5. The man was not so sacred. Now, so she believes her prayer is going to get answered. Go back to Samuel here. And she's no longer sad. Verse 19. So they arose early in the morning, and they worshiped before the Lord, and they returned and came to their house at Ramah. You notice it starts out being called Ramatham Zophim, and now they're abbreviating it to Ramah. This became the home of Samuel all through his ministry. And Elkanah knew his wife, and the Lord remembered her. So it came to pass in the process of time, the typical 9 months, that Hannah conceived and bare a son and called his name Samuel, because I've asked him from the Lord. Samuel means God hears. Now the man Elkanah and all his house went yearly up to offer to the Lord and to sacrifice his vow. He's a priest. Every Hebrew man was supposed to go 3 times up before the Lord. And so he's going up to do his feast at least once a year, was required. But Hannah did not go up, for she said to her husband, not until the child is weaned, then I will take him, that he might appear before the Lord and remain there forever. Now you're wondering, at what point did she tell Elkanah, I've made a deal with God? You know, when she first prays the prayer, she maybe didn't say anything because she's, well, I'm not pregnant yet. And then finally she has a baby and she's thinking, I made a vow to God. She's so excited. They don't do ultrasound, but she knows it's a boy. Because she said, Lord, if you'll give me a man child, right? And at some point she's got to tell Elkanah, I've made a vow. And you know, biblically, someone's going to throw stones at me for this, but it's in the Bible. Take it up with God. If a man made a vow, he had to pay it. If a woman made a vow while she was married, the husband had the right to annul that vow or to let it stand. Now, I'm not going to go into it. I'm just telling you what the Bible said. So here, she's maybe telling him for the first time, and he's got the right to annul her vow. But he doesn't. He believes that God answered her prayer and that it is a miracle. And Elkanah, verse 23, her husband said, "Do what seems best to you. Wait until you've weaned him. Only let the Lord establish his word." He's a man of faith, isn't he? When you find out Samuel grows up and he becomes a great person who transforms the nation, he's got a good father and he's got a good mother. She is a godly mother. "Only let the Lord establish his word." Then the woman stayed and nursed her son until she had weaned him. Now, there's great debate on how old was Samuel when she brings him to the house of the Lord. You know, typically in our culture around the world today, a baby may be nursed anywhere from 10 months, 18 months, maybe two. As near as we can tell, three in ancient times, and that you would think was a long time, but when a mother had several children, she may still have other younger children that were nursing. It might not be uncommon to, when putting a toddler to bed, to nurse him. They didn't have all the formula on the shelves of the supermarket back then, and so they depended more on God's means. But I read in some of the ancient rabbis, and they talked about how a mother wrote one time, she said, "I carried you for 9 months, and I weaned you for 3 years. Or nursed you for 3 years." And so at the long end, three. The teaching and the training she gave during those first 3 years cast his life in a spiritual direction for the rest of his life. The mother of Moses. How long did Jochebed have Moses? Pharaoh's daughter said to Miriam and to Jochebed, "Here's your wages. You nurse the child, and when he's weaned, you bring him to the palace." He may have been 5 or 6 because they may have kept him a little longer. But boy, it just really impresses you with how important those early years are. But in everything she did, in her disposition, Hannah, the whole time she's taking care of Samuel, she knows that she is training him to be a leader in the nation. He's been given to her by God, and that he is going to be exposed to great evil. Boy, that would take a lot of faith to bring a baby 3 or 4 years old. I mean, it's just hard for me to even imagine three, but everything I read, they said that would have been the long end of it. And he's, you know, kind of paper trained at that point. And he's up there eating solid food, and to hand him over into the temple must have taken incredible faith. All the time that she spent with him teaching him, she might have even taught him to read. I know you think that's hard to believe. Do you know that John Wesley could read through the entire Bible? Susanna Wesley taught him to read the entire Bible when he was 5 years old. But he may have learned some simple alphabet at three. Children can learn that. But at his mother's knee, he was learning these things. And how tender that time must have been. And every moment she says, "I'm not going to the feast because I know someday I'm going to have to go up and leave him there. I'm going to keep him with me every minute that I can." And so she kept her son. And she trained him. And finally, when she had weaned him, verse 24, she took him up with her with 3 bowls and 1 ephah of flour and a skin of wine and brought them to the house of the Lord in Shiloh. And the child was young. Makes it clear, doesn't it? Then they slaughtered a bull and they brought the child to Eli. And she said, "Oh my Lord, as your soul lives, my Lord, I am the woman who stood by here praying to the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me my petition, which I asked of him. Therefore now I have lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he has lent to the Lord." So they worshiped there, and Hannah prayed. They worshiped, and they're leaving the child. By the way, you know why? You notice it says here they brought, it tells you what they brought. They brought three bowls and they brought some flour and they brought a full skin of wine, because it's not real nice to just drop your kid off and said, you raise him now. Tell you a quick story. One of the longest trips I've ever taken was coming from South Africa back to America. First time I went, it was just Stephen and I, who just graduated college. We took him, he was 7 years old. On the way back from South Africa, the flight leaves at night from Johannesburg. That whole day, they wanted to give us all the final tours, and we toured several places. He took us to a gold mine and stuff, and that night, the pastor took us to the airport. We got on the plane, and it was like a 747. I was in coach class with Stephen. He was awake all day long. He found another kid on the plane. They played all the way from South Africa to Atlanta. I said, aren't you tired? Aren't you going to? No, no. He was awake in Atlanta. Then we flew to from Atlanta to Salt Lake City. And it was, you know, 24 hours, it seemed like. In Salt Lake City, just as we're landing, he finally goes to sleep. He had not slept since the morning of leaving South Africa. That kid's wired. And he's getting off the plane. He's 7 years old. I've got to carry my luggage and carry him off the plane. He's just totally out of it. So it's like, you know, you're carrying a corpse off the plane. And I get off the plane and I bring him over to the waiting area to catch our final flight to Sacramento, and there's all these, you know, nice Mormon missionaries there in Salt Lake City and grandmas and things. And he's, I laid him down on the seats, and I've been sitting on the plane. I got to run and use the restroom real quick. And you don't want to leave a seven-year-old. And so I saw this lady there, and I said, I'm just going to leave him for a minute, and I'll be right back. And she looked real worried. And so I said, now, if I don't come back, make sure and get him a good education. And then she laughed. She realized, because she looked worried, like I wasn't going to come back. But, you know, here they drop off this through, and they said, I gave him to the Lord. Now, if someone did that to us here at the church, what would we do? Here's my three-year-old. I've given him to the Lord. Some of you are getting ideas by that. But you notice they brought three bulls. They sacrificed one. The most expensive animal you could offer was a bull. That was an oxen was very expensive. So they got skin of wine, they got flour, they got the oxen. They said, we're going to cover the cost. And we supplied his clothes. And here he is to worship the Lord. And they can see from his long hair, he's a Nazirite, consecrated to God. And then Hannah prays before the Lord. This is one of the most beautiful prayers in the Bible. I'm going to read this to you. My heart rejoices in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. I smile at my enemies because I rejoice in your salvation. No one is holy like the Lord, for there is none beside you, nor is there any rock like our rock. Talk no more so proudly, nor let arrogance come from your mouth, for the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The bow of the mighty men are broken, and those who stumbled are girded with strength. Those who are mighty are weak. The weak are strong. Notice you'll see this transition all through her prayer. Those who are full have hired themselves out for bread, and the hungry have ceased to hunger. Even the barren has borne seven, and she who has many children has become feeble. Now I want to pause right there, because that's a really prophetic statement. There are seven examples, and you may have heard me touch on this before, in the Bible, of women who were barren that had miracle births. You can name them with me real quick. I'll start with Sarah, Rebecca. All three wives, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, it says they were barren, but then through a miracle, they had prayer. They had a baby. Their miracle, a prayer, they had a baby. Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, the Shunammite woman, Samson's mother, John the Baptist's mother. Who am I forgetting? Hannah, there it is. Yeah, the one I'm talking about right now. I thought I'm leaving someone out. Hannah. So that's seven. All of them, when they had a miracle birth, all the babies were boys. Why is that? Because all those miracle births are types of Christ. You've got Abraham has Isaac, type of Christ. He's offered by the Father. You've got Jacob, who's the father of the patriarchs. You've got Joseph, Rachel's son, who ends up saving the nation as Jesus saved. He forgave his brothers that sold him as Jesus forgave those that sold him. Samson, who becomes the great deliverer. Do you know what it says about Samson? He slew more by his death than he did by his life of the enemies of God's people. He stretches out his arms, he sacrifices himself like Jesus. You got the Shunammite's son. He's out in the field laboring with his father. Christ is out laboring in the field. The harvest is great. And he's resurrected. A resurrection is a type of Christ. And here you've got Samuel, who ends up becoming prophet, judge, and priest of the nation that brings them back to God. Jesus is our prophet, our priest, and our judge. And then John the Baptist is the last one. So the barren has borne seven, she says in her prayer. Anyway, so this is just a wonderful story. And you can read also, for instance, in Isaiah 54, verse 3, "Sing, O barren, you who have not borne, break forth into singing and cry aloud, you who have not labored with child. For more are the children of the desolate than the children of the married woman, says the Lord. Enlarge the place of your tent, and let them stretch out the curtains of your dwellings. Do not spare. Lengthen your cords, and strengthen your stakes. For you shall expand to the right and the left, and your descendants will inherit the nations and make the desolate cities inhabited." What is he talking about here? He's talking about growing the church. Hannah is a type of the church. Sometimes we may feel barren, but it was through a miracle that she gave birth. And then it's really pretty. You read here, if you go to chapter 2 of Samuel, it says, "Samuel ministered before the Lord, even as a child, wearing a linen ephod." He's like a little priest. "Moreover, his mother used to make him a little robe and bring it to him." What does clothing represent? It's a symbol of like righteousness. "And she'd bring it to him year by year when she came up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice." Notice the regularity. It talks about them year by year they come. "And Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife and say, 'The Lord give you descendants from this woman for the loan that was given to the Lord.'" Samuel was such a good boy. He was so dependable. He was so spiritual. And Eli saw in Samuel what he had always wanted in his own sons. He felt like he was a failure as a father, but he thought, with this boy, I don't want to make the same mistake. And Eli did everything he could to train him right. And so he loved Samuel. And so he prayed that God would bless Elkanah and Hannah. And you know what it says? They would go to their own home, and the Lord visited Hannah so that she conceived and bore three sons and two daughters. Meanwhile, the child Samuel grew up before the Lord. She'd bring him his coat every year. Now, this is a story of salvation, because what's the greatest gift that you could give? Wouldn't it be to, you think, well, what can I give more than my life? Do parents love their children more than their lives? And so to give your child to the Lord, that'd be the greatest gift. Now, isn't this what the Lord did for us? God so loved the world, he gave his son. And so, you know, there's just something about a mother's love. You even see it in the animal kingdom. It says, a mother bear robbed of her cubs than to meet a fool in his folly. In the Bible, it talks about the fury of a mother. A mother, Jesus said, he said, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often I would have delivered you. And I wanted to protect you under my wings as a hen does her chicks, but you would not." He talks about the protection of the mother for its children. I remember walking down the road one time and I came upon a mother quail and all her little, they just hatched. They were just little peepers, about that big. Quail are small anyway, and these are little bitty things. They look like ants running across the ground. And I stumbled on the nest walking through the woods. And you know what the mother did? She ran at me, not to attack me, she ran at me and began to flutter around in a circle to distract me, looking like she had a broken wing, stuck out one wing and began to do this strange dance, and you become so distracted, and she gives this call, and all of the little chicks run off in the grass so you can't see them, but she was like offering, she was exposing herself right here at my feet, so I'd go after her and the chicks would escape. God pre-wires mothers somehow. It's probably a good thing, or we would devour our young, right? But he pre-wires mothers to love and to protect their young. And so for a mother to say, I am going to love the Lord even more than my child, you know, that's what I think makes a godly mother a godly mother, is that God comes first even before the children. Seek first the kingdom of God. And to say, I'm going to put the Lord first. Hannah is a wonderful example. You know, she said, if you'll give your maidservant a child, you know what Mary said when the angel spoke to her? Be it unto your maidservant, as you said. Hannah begins the era of the kings with a miracle birth. Mary begins the era of the King of Kings with a miracle birth. Hannah the Old Testament, Mary the New Testament. But Samuel is certainly a type of Christ. And it's just talking about the greatest love. And you know what happens when you give to the Lord? When you give your best gift to the Lord, what could you give more valuable than your child? Did God give back? She gave one. She got five back. So whatever you give to the Lord, can you outgive God? Wouldn't you have been worried if you had gone maybe 15 years of marriage, no children? Finally, you have one. Would you want to give that one away? You'd say, man, it took me forever to have one. She gives that one away. And because she trusted the Lord, he gave her five more. You know, it's always a kind of a tough message because I've had people come to me and say, Pastor Doug, my spouse and I, we've been trying to have children for years. And, you know, it's always hard to hear a Mother's Day sermon. And I know that. I can appreciate that that would be difficult. I also know several friends that waited and waited to have children, and they adopted. And you know what happens right after they adopt? How many of you know someone like that? So, you never know what God might have planned for you. But this is really a message about the church and about Jesus. And in the way that she gave him to serve the nation, God gave his son to save the world. And the whole nation was brought back to God and delivered from their enemies because of the life of Samuel. And really, but it's a story about Jesus. And God so loving the world, he gave his son and his love for us. And that's why we're going to sing a familiar song for this Mother's Day message. Jesus loves me. Any of you know that? Why don't we stand together? We'll bring our song leaders out and we'll sing that.